Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hello and welcome to another Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny and this is just a brief intervention from me to introduce our new co-host, Becky Hogg. Becky is very kindly standing in for our other Rebecca, Rebecca Watson, while she's away travelling. And I'm sure you'll remember that Becky guest-hosted an episode of the show last year. Becky Hogg is a freelance writer, a researcher and formerly an executive director of the Open Rights Group. She writes and broadcasts on technology, civil rights and intellectual property, and so is right at home to interview our guest on tonight's show, Yevgeny Morozov. And this is fortunate, as due to the iniquity of the Tube Network, Becky ended up having to record this interview on her own. So it's something of a baptism of fire as a Little Atoms presenter for Becky, so I hope you enjoy the interview.
Yevgeny Morozov was born in Belarus in 1984. He's a contributing editor at Foreign Policy and runs the magazine's Net Effect blog. He's currently a visiting scholar at Stanford and a fellow at the New America Foundation. He's also been a fellow at George Soros' Open Society Institute, and he remains there on the board of the Information Programme. Before moving to the US, Morozov was based in Berlin and Prague, where he was director of new media at Transitions Online, a media development NGO active in the former Soviet bloc. The Net Delusion, How Not to Liberate the World, is his first book, and it's out now, published by Alan Lane.
Welcome to Little Atoms,
Yevgeny.
Good to be here.
So in The Net Delusion, you argue that Washington's current obsession with internet freedom is based on a flawed understanding of the role that free information had to play in the fall of the Soviet Union. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I mean, that's not the only fallacy in the approach to internet freedom, but I think the assumption that information, but also, you know, technologies like the fax machine and the photocopier and also Western broadcasting were fundamental and were, you know, crucial to the downfall of the Soviet Union definitely plays a strong role in determining what to do about blogging, what to do about tweeting, what to do about the internet when it comes to setting policy on China or Iran or even Russia. And I think the problem here is that while all those technologies played some role in abetting the dissidents, in helping them to spread information with the local population, they were not, of course, the factor that caused the downfall of the Soviet Union. It was all about the economy. It was all about the military competition with NATO. And the problem with attributing too much importance to those factors is that, you know, many people in Washington believe that the moment they start providing tools that will help to pierce through the Great Firewall of China, they'll have exactly the same effect that, you know, destroying the Berlin Wall had. And of course, this is an illusion. And this, I think, leads to a slightly biased understanding of what blogging is and what blogging does. Not every blogger is a dissident, right? So when people in Washington and Hillary Clinton, for example, in a speech last year, made an explicit comparison between bloggers and dissidents. And the problem here is that, you know, there are many bloggers in a country like Russia or a country like Iran who are actually much more conservative than their current leaders, right? And it's by labeling them as dissidents, we're kind of missing the part that, you know, in many cases, blogging actually, you know, bloggers spread ideas that end up legitimizing the government. Mm-hmm. So we have to be much more sophisticated and much, you know, those are much more complex technologies than the ones that we used previously.
Yeah.
And we have to be careful not to expect identical political outcomes from their use as, you know, was the case in the late 80s.
You also talk a bit about metaphors and how the metaphors are wrong. The Berlin Wall was the big iconic image of the fall of the Soviet Union. And now the firewall looks like something we need to pierce, something we need to break through. But it's more complicated than that, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, metaphors are inevitable. And, you know, any policy setting environment because they provide you with, you know, cognitive shortcuts or an idea. I mean, many of the ideas that, you know, originate and emerge in public discourse, they are based on metaphors, in part because people need a catchier and easy to understand concept that they may borrow from other field. The problem was applying metaphors in this particular, you know, field of internet freedom studies, you know, if you wish, is that many of them conceal more than they reveal. So we end up in situations where, again, the expectation is that, you know, the moment you break down the Great Firewall of China, you'll have the same impact that the fall of the Berlin Wall had. And of course, the firewall and the Berlin Wall are completely different because, you know, you can easily patch the firewall 2 hours after it's broken down, and you cannot easily rebuild the Berlin Wall. And it's the same with, as I've mentioned, with treating samizdat as a kind of an equivalent to blogging. Right? So now, again, we are going through many of the same rehashed metaphors and many of the same rehashed, you know, approaches. Now Hillary Clinton again talks about the information curtain that is descending on, you know, authoritarian states, the way Winston Churchill spoke about the Iron Curtain. And some of those metaphors help to build up the profile of the problem because people immediately realize what's at stake, but often they also mislead because, you know, all of those metaphors were used in a particular historical context and many people expect similar outcomes where they shouldn't.
We want to talk a bit about your approach to social media. You're quick to highlight in the book how the tools that cyber utopians tout as revolutionary, Twitter, Facebook, can just as easily be employed by repressive regimes to their own ends, both through surveillance but also through propaganda. Can you talk a little bit about some of the examples that you give in the book? Because a lot of them are quite new. We were talking before that you didn't have a research assistant for this book, but the bibliography is sort of 70 pages long in the book. It's very impressive. And one of the things I enjoyed most about your book was how much evidence you rallied against, rallied with your arguments. What kind of evidence do you present in the book about social media being used by repressive regimes?
Before we jump to the evidence part, I mean, like, the reason why I spent so much time on outlining this sort of and highlighting this contrarian cases is because I think the current, you know, paradigm of thinking about internet freedom and thinking about internet and democracy is flawed. And, you know, so I'm trying to accumulate counter evidence that will allow me to show that, you know, certain governments are as active as dissidents and as activists and using the web, or that, you know, perhaps the focus should be not on piercing through firewalls, but it should be on making sure that American companies cannot sell technology to build those firewalls, right? So, I mean, there are, I think, many issues here which need to be reconsidered, because this old paradigm, which does derive from the Cold War era, needs to be replaced with something else that does not operate on this simplistic reductionist assumptions. In terms of the, you know, evidence, I look at many examples from countries ranging from, you know, Venezuela to Belarus to, you know, China and Iran. In Iran, for example, what we saw immediately in the aftermath of the protests in 2009 was that the Iranian police actually went through many of the social media websites collecting information about anyone who used tweets and Facebook to campaign against the government. And then they tried to identify those people and they arrested some of them. We also saw that the government went collecting photos and videos posted to Flickr and YouTube and other social media websites, and then they republished some of those photos on the websites of government agencies and government news sites, and they asked people to identify if they can recognize any of the people in the photos. Right? So again, a very terrifying, a very terrifying example of how crowdsourcing can be used to identify, you know, dissent. But we're also seeing something more sinister and something more long-term happening in a country like Belarus, where you get the KGB, which is still retains its name from the old era, perhaps, you know, that being a very strong brand, which the government, you know, doesn't want to abandon that easily. They, for example, go through social networking profiles of activists that they already know about, and then they look at their friends lists, and then they try to jot down the names of anyone who they were not previously aware of. And, you know, they would often invite those people down for interrogation and ask them, how are you connected to the opposition? Why did you travel to Poland, to Lithuania? and much of it, of course, was traveling related to some training by, you know, foreign governments and whatnot. So, I mean, there are all sorts of ways in which they are exploring the social media space for tips and hints about the potential oppositional activities. But then there is also a lot of, you know, activity happening in terms of propaganda. We see, you know, some paid bloggers in China trying to manipulate discussions online. We also see a lot of websites that are popular being set up in Russia with the government's blessing, with the government's funding, some of them to manipulate public discussion, some of them simply to, you know, feed the public with the politicized entertainment, which occasionally features some extremely ideological political ideas thrown in between. So it all differs country by country, but the key message here is that, you know, the governments are taking active advantage of this space, and that, you know, in many cases, they are much more creative in using the space than the activists.
I've been following you on Twitter as you've been writing this book. I don't know, how long has it taken you to write this book?
It's a very difficult question.
Okay.
The actual writing was 6 months, but I did a lot of research, you know, for several years prior to that. So it's you know, I didn't have a timer to, you know.
And during that time, I've seen you on Twitter and in your various columns hold up the sort of cyber utopian digital guru style commentators for not paying attention to evidence and for rehashing stories again and again that really didn't have much basis. How has that kind of activity been received by these people? I mean, Clay Shirky is one person that you've held up quite vehemently.
Well, I don't think it helped me to receive more Christmas cards. So I don't think, you know, my fan club is growing among internet gurus. But, you know, some of them have changed their position somewhat. I mean, even Clay Shirky, I think, has moved closer to my position on many issues, particularly on the issue of U.S. government's own involvement in this space and internet freedom issues. Others, I think, are also beginning to reconsider their own previous stance. Some journalists are beginning to reconsider their enthusiastic portrayal of this space. I think it's too soon to tell whether the debate is turning, but I think there is definitely, you know, looking at what happened in Tunisia just, you know, a week ago, and looking at the kind of coverage that it received in the media, you know, I think the situation could have been, in terms of, you know, media hyping up WikiLeaks on Twitter, I think the situation could have been much worse. So, you know, if you compare Tunisia to Iran, I mean, in Iran, there was even no revolution. The government stayed in power, and we still heard about Twitter revolution in virtually every newspaper. I mean, now there is still some hype. Some of the same people are hyping up, you know, the WikiLeaks revolution in Tunisia. But I think it's better than it could have been. You know, I think people are a little bit more restrained, in part because I think some have also understand the consequences. Yeah. That, you know, by labeling it a Twitter revolution, what is likely to happen is that other governments will actually go and start cracking down on the internet, right? So that will be the immediate aftermath of, you know, proclaiming it to be a Twitter revolution, is that all Arab dictators will just, you know, be much more concerned about cyberspace, will start intimidating and harassing bloggers, will impose a stricter internet censorship scheme, and, you know, so again, and it's also part of my argument that, you know, a lot depends on what we say and how we frame issues. And we don't want, we may still be doing a lot of good and benign things in the West, but we don't necessarily have to talk about it. We don't have to publicize the fact that someone from the State Department decided to reach out to Twitter and ask them to delay maintenance. It was a well-intentioned during the Twitter protest.
You're talking about Jared Cohen's memo to Twitter.
Yes. I discuss it. It lands in the book, this famous act of, you know, State Department official sending a note to Twitter during the protest in Iran and asking them to delay maintenance of planned maintenance of their site because that might disrupt the protests. And of course, that was then interpreted by every single government that doesn't like the U.S. as a fact of American interference and as a fact of, you know, American basically, you know, steering of the protests via cyberspace. And I think it was probably a good move on behalf of the State Department to send the message to Twitter, which I think, you know, it just shows you how short-sighted people at Twitter are, that they even chose to have maintenance during the protest in Iran. But, you know, that aside, I think the mistake there was to leak it to the New York Times and have it as front-page news, right? So again, there is, I think, this often invisible layer on top of most decisions that policymakers need to be aware of. They need to know that technology is political, and that responses to their actions, even those actions are just limited to the technology space, will still have political repercussions.
And of course, as you pointed out recently, the fact that Twitter has been subpoenaed and that's been made public by the US Department of Justice for various records in the WikiLeaks investigation doesn't help Twitter's perception around the world.
Actually, in this case, I think it helps Twitter's perceptions because Twitter went on the record to publicize the fact that they got a D order. It's slightly different from a subpoena.
Oh, sorry.
But that aside, it does damage the reputation of the U.S. government. I mean, so again, I think Twitter emerged very fine from this, development. But the U.S. government, I think, is having its reputation damaged, and of course, it no longer can claim the high moral ground in terms of promoting internet freedom abroad when it seems to be persecuting it at home, right? So sure. and this, I think, what is so painful about watching this internet freedom agenda in the State Department is that it's completely unconnected or disconnected from what the U.S. government is doing domestically. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're doing a lot of nasty things domestically, so we don't want necessarily to tie the internet freedom agenda to all that nasty stuff. But, given that obvious disconnect, of course, the perceptions of hypocrisy and duplicity are inevitable, when you look at it from abroad.
Is that what it is, then? It's just simply a disconnect? Because people, you mentioned Hillary Clinton's famous January speech. That's now been remixed on YouTube a million times to show the hypocrisy with regards to WikiLeaks and other domestic policies, as you point out. But it strikes me you're actually being incredibly pragmatic in your advice to policymakers about the internet. And that's why it's so shocking that you've been painted as this exotic Andrew Keen figure who's just a naysayer. But I, all the way through reading it, I wanted to know whether you took the State Department's internet freedom agenda at face value, or whether, as someone who knows Beltway politics very well, you saw something else at play there.
And what else would that be?
Well, I don't know.
I don't think it's Taliban which is steering the, so I'm like, I don't know.
But is it an attempt to, for example, actually promote some of the internet freedom quashing agendas that are going through in other parts of the government,
never underestimate the naivete of American diplomats. I think some of them genuinely believe in what they're doing. And, I don't think that they wake up and every morning think about internet freedom as, a value in itself, as a good in itself. I mean, for them, it's more about finding a way to open up China, open up Iran, open up, other countries. I mean, most of them are genuinely committed to this. Spending time in Washington, they may be a little bit naive in pursuing that goal, but they do believe in pursuing it, genuinely. It's just that, My problem here is really not so much in their ambitions to use the internet. It's that the way in which they frame this issue and the way in which they give meaning to the concept of internet freedom is bound to, push them to take wrong sides and to make wrong decisions and to err and to basically, miss the political and social repercussions of their own acts, right? And this is what bothers me so much, that as a foundation for policy, the internet freedom, in quotation marks, as a policy objective, makes no sense. And, it's probably likely to harm than to benefit. And so my problem is not so much with particular policies, right? It's with the fact and with the way in which those policies are brought together under the umbrella of internet freedom, which I think is a terrible term given what's happening domestically. I think it's a terrible term because, it sends a very ambiguous message to other governments because they don't know what exactly is being promoted. They don't know whether the U.S. is promoting just, freedom off the internet, or whether they're promoting freedom via the internet, whether they expect that young people will use Facebook and Twitter to go and organize and go and point to the streets the way they did in Iran, or that they would actually, all they want is just to make sure that it's harder to censor the internet. And, you look at that others, if you assume it's the later, right? I mean, it's, God, why is it going after, Amazon and PayPal and others, right? I mean, so again, if you are trying to analyze it from the perspective of a foreign government, it does look like what it is. It's just a cover-up for regime change by cyberspace. And I think this is what triggers so much of the counter-reaction. You look at what happened in Russia, for example, after the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. Russians assumed that it all happened because America and others were basically training the opposition, but we're also creating all sorts of youth movements. in those countries, right? So they would go and train young people, they train them in new media, and they'll have this active pro-Western, pro-democracy youth movements that will go in and topple the regime. So what did the Russians do? They created their own youth movements, right? They created their, you know, pro-Kremlin, extremely conservative, socially conservative youth movements, right? And those youth movements now emerged as much more, you know, aggressive and much more of a potent force than, you know, any youth movement that the West could ever hope to put together in Russia. And now it's the youth movements who go and beat up journalists, you know, and who go and basically engage in repression that the government doesn't have to engage in. And the same kind of, you know, counter-reaction we will see when it comes to the internet. Again, if the governments perceive that they are being challenged and, you know, are on the brink of being overthrown by means of new media, of course they'll start investing in their own bloggers, their own cyber police, and their own, you know, search engines and their own websites to minimize the risk and the damage. So I think there has to be this awareness that the way in which we let our actions to be interpreted will actually influence the policies of the countries whom we're trying to influence. And this is what bothers me so much about the concept of internet freedom, because it hides all of those, you know, consequences that are likely to follow.
Not simply from governments around the world, but from the US government itself. It hides that from policymakers, so they can't then think rationally in the way that you've outlined. Sure. You talk about internet centrism, and you also, a lot of people who make the sorts of arguments that you're making end up calling the internet just a tool. But I'm really interested, at the end of the book, you sort of, you reject that as well. You say, actually, we need to be cyber realists. And I wanted to ask you, how do we need to train ourselves to think in order to become cyber realists?
You know, I think cyber realism is more, you know, it's not a way of thought. It's not a way of thinking. It's not, you know, I'm not offering a set of particular assumptions that you need to assume in order to make effective policy. It's more a matter of deciding, you know, how we learn. It's more like an epistemological method, actually. You know, it's who do you get to hear from when you set policy, and who gets to decide what when it comes to subjects like internet freedom. I mean, I think that part of the problem with the current approach is that much of it is shaped and decided by people with very little experience in foreign policy. It's decided by people who know everything about Silicon Valley, but nothing about, you know, religious seminaries in Qom in Iran, or about, you know, the history of Chinese foreign policy. And the problem is that when you focus so much on the promise of the tool, you end up completely missing the political environment that is shaping how the tool is being used and perceived. So part of my suggestion, you know, behind the cyber realist agenda is that we'd better not to have any assumptions about the way the internet will shape it, or have as few assumptions as possible, and instead try to empower people who are much more knowledgeable about the context. Mm. Right. So it's, in a sense, it's a very pragmatic argument about how you should split power within something like the State Department. So I'm basically proposing to take as much power away from the technologists and empower people with regional and topical expertise. Mm. And I think, you know, to me, if you really have to, you know, if your task is to analyze the impact of the internet on a country like Russia or China, I mean, chances are you'll be far better off in that job if you know more about Russia than you do about the internet, right? Because the internet is really simple. You know, it makes it easier for people to find each other, cooperate, and find information. You know, you don't need a PhD to know that. And then what ends up happening is that we have all these internet gurus now, you know, who know all those three things, making up this very complex, you know, analysis of, you know, how the internet is likely to shape authoritarian states, while they know almost nothing about those authoritarian states. You know, and this is what leads to this current, I think, very shallow intellectual debate, because it's all driven by assumptions about the internet and not about assumptions about authoritarian states.
Sure. You've been following the WikiLeaks story obsessively since about the midsummer, pausing only to sleep at some points. Where are you at in your thinking? Well, if your Twitter feed's anything to go by, anyway. I don't know if you have bots tweeting everything that happens in Wikipedia
whilst you get on with other things. You know, sweatshops tweeting on my behalf.
Where are you at in your thinking on WikiLeaks at the moment, and what do you hope will happen this year?
You know, it's, again, I think we have to draw a distinction between WikiLeaks, the entity, and WikiLeaks, the social movement. And if you look at the kind of movement that now surrounds WikiLeaks, I mean, it's all pushing in different directions. Some people are pushing towards, you know, minimizing government secrecy. Some are pushing for better whistleblowing laws. Some are pushing for creating a better and more resilient decentralized internet infrastructure, which is a new way to run domain name systems, with a new way to host sites, with a new way to raise money. And all of them, I think, have different, chances of succeeding. I would bet on the infrastructure people to probably making more, progress than the others. But again, it's just my own personal perception. When it comes to WikiLeaks, the organization, I mean, frankly, I don't know what's in store for them, because I just don't think they have a coherent strategy for the future, in part because their current strategy is to remain an intermediary. You know, they want to be a place where they take data and then pass it on to someone else. And the problem is that if the internet has taught us anything, it's that the intermediaries are on their way out. It's something that bothers me a lot, that, you know, I just don't see why you would want to leak something to WikiLeaks if you can leak it directly to New York Times. I mean, so right now, the only reason I see for doing that is because WikiLeaks has a secure technology for you to upload the documents. Right? If you, on the other hand, build the same technology into the New York Times website, I just don't see where the value added is. The value added may be in, having someone at WikiLeaks to process the data and figure out which news entity is likely to benefit from it the most, which NGOs might benefit from it the most. But then, you know, you run into the problem of WikiLeaks having to hire a lot of analysts who need to know as much as, you know, CIA analysts. And, you know, the people who are doing this role right now are journalists at The Guardian and their and elsewhere. It's not done internally within WikiLeaks. Mm. So for WikiLeaks to remain functional and be effective in the future, they'll have to have a complete, you know, revamp of their operations and become something else entirely. Right. So I don't see much future for WikiLeaks as it is now. I do see some future for them if they, you know, remake themselves, but I can't really tell which way they'll choose to go.
I think it's interesting because I think the model that you've just described, where the New York Times gets its own secure infrastructure, is something that OpenLeaks, Daniel Domschmidt-Berg's new project, is perhaps working more towards. But I'm not sure. I missed that talk at the Chaos Computer Conference.
I read the transcript of the talk just yesterday, and I found it very incoherent. but I don't think they are so much interested in building. They're definitely interested in building an open infrastructure for their project. I mean, they're not interested in rebuilding, the way we host websites or the way in which we arrange our payment systems. Yeah. Right. So, I mean, I'm curious to see what comes out of that. I think, you know, so far they probably have a more resilient model than WikiLeaks itself, in part because WikiLeaks itself now has a good brand, and all they do is just, you know, they hope that someone high profile will leak data to them. So it's not, it doesn't scale, let's put it that way. So, mm-hmm. I mean, OpenLeaks might scale a bit better. But again, much here depends on who they choose to partner with. Because, yeah. You know, as now we have all realized, it all depends on who publishes the revelations based on the leaks, and then who helps you to defend yourself against people who would like to take you down. I mean, there are many more elements to this than just the score of the network, and we really have to evaluate the effectiveness of this project based on who is involved, not just based on who is at the center.
Yevgeny Morozov, thank you very much for coming on Little Atoms. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.